The Christian life is one that begins at a certain point in our lives. Whether we became a Christian early on as a child or later on as an adult, usually we can point to some, at least period in time, where we can say, that's when I became a Christian. And then the rest of life is lived out in such a way that we, day by day, moment by moment, ratify that decision, that choice that we made when we became a Christian. We ratify it through our actions, those of seeking to understand God better, through study of the Scriptures, study of the Bible, our unique, authoritative source of truth. We ratify that decision by just even the desires that we have to deal with within our own hearts and our own minds. The desire to do that which is wrong as we struggle with it and seek to do what's right. The desire to do what's right, and we choose to do that. And we see our destiny sort of playing out in front of our eyes as we know that eventually, one of these days, our entire experience will be one of doing only that which is right. Or when we do what is wrong, when we desire to do what's wrong, not just the struggle, but then when we actually succumb to that temptation and our anger, our lust, our envy, our frustration just comes spilling out of our hearts through our words and our actions, and the sense of guilt that we feel. And what do we do with that? But we bring that before a righteous and holy and merciful God, seeking His forgiveness. And that in and of itself ratifies our Christianity. That's authentic Christianity. It's all of these things that the Apostle Paul has been dealing with in his letter to the Corinthians called 2 Corinthians, where he's been under attack by false teachers who have come into the church of Corinth, a church, a group of people whom he has loved dearly, sought to nurture in their faith, in their understanding of God, and then they turned on him. In his response was one to basically get right back in their face in a nurturing and loving way and say, you're wrong. And to work out his relationship with them, seeking to remind them of the truth and to encourage them to do what's right. So all through this letter, we have seen Paul's intimate relationship with the Corinthians comes spilling out of the words on these pages. In other words, we've been listening in on a very heartfelt and profound relationship or dialogue in a relationship between this man Paul and these people whom he saw begin their Christianity because of their response to the message that he had proclaimed to them in Corinth. Well, right in the middle of this letter, as Paul continues in this dialogue with them, after he has assured them that he is assured of the authenticity of their Christianity, primarily because of the response to their sin, that the grief over their sin in rejecting God, as they were rejecting Paul, has led to a renewed vengeance on their part to correct their minds and their behavior and to do what's right. And Paul goes on then to say, as long as we're on the subject of your ratifying and authenticating your Christianity, there's one more issue I'd like to discuss with you. And that is the promise that you made a year ago to give a financial gift to your impoverished Jewish brothers and sisters in Christ back in Judea who are starving to death because of a famine that's taking place there. That as long as we're on the subject, you need to follow through on the desire that you had to give this gift. And that also will be a proving out of the authenticity of your Christianity. And so that's where we are in this letter. A little parenthesis, because Paul is going to go back in chapter 10 to the previous subject of sort of defending himself against these false teachers who have come into Corinth and pointing out that he is the authentic apostle. His Christianity is authentic. He's going to go back to that in chapter 10. But chapter 9, which we want to look at today, is the second part of this little parenthesis where he's encouraging the Corinthians to do good with respect to what they had said that they were going to do even a year ago. So let's look at this then. First of all, verses 1 through 4, chapter 9 of 2 Corinthians. For it is superfluous for me to write to you about this ministry to the saints. For I know your readiness, of which I boast about you to the Macedonians, namely that Achaia has been prepared since last year, and your zeal has stirred up most of them. But I have sent the brethren in order that our boasting about you may not be made empty in this case, so that, as I was saying, you may be prepared. Otherwise, if any Macedonians come with me and find you unprepared, we, not to speak of you, will be put to shame by this confidence. Paul starts this chapter, it is really unnecessary for me to write to you about this service that I'm talking to you about, the service of giving a financial gift to your poor brothers and sisters back in Judea. It's unnecessary. Why? He says in verse 2, I know your readiness. I know you're prepared, of which I have actually boasted about you to the Macedonians, that Achaia, that would be the Corinthians in southern Greece, they're ready to give, he has boasted to the Macedonians. The Macedonians in northern Greece is where he is right now. You recall that he has come over from Ephesus because of this tension between the Corinthian church over here in Greece and himself in Ephesus in Turkey. He got a little nervous, was getting nervous, because he had sent Titus to try to encourage the Corinthians to come back to the truth. Titus hadn't shown up yet in Ephesus, so Paul begins his journey back to Corinth by going north to Macedonia. Then he's going to eventually drop down south into Corinth near Athens. So he's up in the Philippi and Thessalonica area, and that's where he's writing. And so he's boasted to the Macedonians about the preparedness of the Corinthians. And so he says, basically, I know it's unnecessary for me to write to you. Well, then why are you writing? Well, maybe because it's, you can kind of hear him, even in the last chapter. He said to them, I'm not commanding you to give this gift to the Judeans. It's just my opinion. On the other hand, prove your love for God by giving this gift. I mean, it's almost as though he's speaking out of both sides of his mouth. But you can hear Paul just trying to deftly walk around this issue or through this issue, wanting not to coerce the Corinthians, not to strong-arm them, but to nurture and encourage them to do what's right. See, this is our role with one another. Sure, we can control people, we can strong-arm them, we can threaten them, we can, you know, whatever we want to do to try to get them to act the way that we want them to act. But Paul doesn't do that. That's not the Christian way? Two, get people to do what's right. The Christian way is to nurture, to support, to help. Yes, maybe to speak honestly, forthrightly, don't hold back, tell me the truth, but gently, please? Nurture me? That's what Paul is doing here. That's the kind of relationship that he had with the people here. That's the kind of relationship that we need with one another. And notice also he says at the end of verse 2, your zeal has stirred up most of them. Now this is interesting because back in chapter 8, he's telling this story about the Macedonian Christians who have given a gift to the Judean Christians. He's telling that story, he's saying, in order to spur the Corinthians on to follow through on their commitment, their desire to actually give a gift. So now he's kind of turning the tables and he's saying, and oh, by the way, the Macedonians decided to give this gift because of your zeal. They're encouraged, they're motivated by what they see in your life. Again, the same sort of thing that ought to be happening amongst us. That when you see someone doing good, be motivated, be encouraged to emulate them, to imitate them, to do as they're doing. That's part of what should be our motivation as Christians, is to almost outdo one another, but at least to imitate each other in doing what's good and what's right. So Paul's saying in verse 1, it's unnecessary for me to write to you, but in verse 3, but I have sent the brethren, the three guys that he mentioned back in chapter 8, Titus again, and two others who were unnamed. But I have sent the brethren, nevertheless, in order that my boasting about you may not be made empty. Just in case it is necessary, I'm sending these three guys to continue to nurture and motivate you to give this gift, so that my boasting about you won't be empty. Or lest, if some of the Macedonians, and that's where I am now, if I bring some of them with me to Corinth, and they arrive, and you guys have basically blown me off on this whole issue of giving this gift, I'm going to be embarrassed. So will the Macedonians, because they're giving because you're giving, and you're going to be embarrassed. See how he's working here? I mean, it's psychological, but it's also real. And it's also a nurturing and encouraging. It's just the reality of how we can encourage one another to do what's right, as Paul's laying it out for us here. So then we go on to verses 5 through 7. So I thought it necessary to urge the brethren that they would go on ahead to you and arrange beforehand your previously promised bountiful gift, so that the same would be ready as a bountiful gift and not affected by covetousness. Just take this a verse at a time here. It was unnecessary to write to you, but it's necessary to urge the brethren that they go on ahead, these three brothers, to help you arrange this previously promised bountiful gift. Now, the word bountiful here could be translated as generous. And if you look up the word generous, I never knew this until I actually looked it up in Webster's this last week. The word generous has two meanings. The primary meaning of generous is freely. I thought that the word generous meant a big amount. If you're generous, then you're giving a lot. That's the secondary meaning of the word. The primary meaning has to do with our motive. That if you're generous, you are giving freely, not holding back. Doesn't matter how much you're giving. You're just simply freely giving. Well, I think that that is the meaning that Paul is intending in this passage here. Because the amount is not the issue. At the end of verse 5, he says that this gift might be ready as a bountiful gift, same word, and not affected by covetousness. Or we could translate it, excuse me just right quick, a gift that is grudgingly granted by greed. Grudgingly granted by greed. I got to hold on what I got, but okay, you can have a little bit. That's grudgingly granted by greed. Paul is saying that's not the way that he wants them to give. He wants them to be generous. The amount ain't the issue. I think the issue is the heart. The issue that they would give freely. And this is why back in chapter 8, if you look, for example, in verse 7 of chapter 8, he says, "But just as you abound in everything, in faith and assurance and knowledge and in all earnestness and love and inspiring, see that you abound in this gracious work also." Paul's calling this act of theirs to give this financial gift to the Judean brothers and sisters a gracious work. The word, it's just one word in the Greek text, literally is grace. That is, that you abound in this grace also. Same thing in verse 19, if you were to look there. That Paul is calling this gift grace. Because grace is giving freely. Now, think about this for a minute with respect to God. Because this is our paradigm. This is our model. He is our model. You and I are sinners. We deserve God's justice, His wrath, and His condemnation for all of eternity. In a sense, God is compelled to mete out His justice. In a sense, God has no choice, but if someone is a sinner, that sinner must be tried, condemned, sentenced, and punished. Basically, God has no choice in the matter. Because of His character, He must exercise His justice. What about His mercy? Doesn't have to do that. He doesn't have to give His mercy. If all He wants to do out of the moral character of His being is be compelled to damn you and me for all of eternity because of our rebellion against His moral character, that's okay. That's all He has to do. But that He is compelled to do. But if He's going to give mercy so that you and I would be forgiven and rescued from His compelled justice, that He must do freely. No compulsion. Oh, I think I'll forgive Ray. Not compelled to, just going to freely choose to do that. That's grace. Grace is freely giving that which someone does not deserve. That's what Paul is talking about here with respect to the generosity of their gift, that they not feel compelled, grudgingly, in this case, no, but freely doing so. And then in verse 6, he quotes this parable, proverb, where it comes from, not exactly sure. So we urge, where am I? Chapter 9, verse 6. "Now this I say, he who sows sparingly will also reap sparingly, and he who sows bountifully will also reap bountifully. He who sows meagerly will reap meagerly. That if you sow only a little, you will receive only a little. If you sow a lot, you will receive a lot." Now the big question here, of course, is exegetically, interpretively, Is he now talking about amount? If you sow, if you give a big amount to Grace Fellowship Church, I promise you that God will increase your income tenfold. But if you don't give very much at all, you're going to be poor. Sound familiar? You can watch it on television every day. That, I don't think, is what Paul's talking about. In this context, the sparing, meager giving, sowing, as a metaphor for giving, he's again talking about the motive, the freedom of the heart. That if you are one who gives freely, then you will be given freely. What will you be given? Salvation. If you don't give freely, grudgingly, then you will be given that, basically, meagerly. What's that? Not salvation, I think, is what he's getting at here. In other words, it's the motive that's the issue, the heart that's the issue here. Where Paul is sort of is saying, if you are a free giver, your heart and your actions are lining up with exactly who God is as a God of grace. If you aren't a free giver, then your heart is not lining up with who God is as a giver of free grace, and therefore you're not a Christian. And I think it's that black and white that he is presenting us with here. So as we go on to verse 7, each one must do just as he purposed in his heart, not grudgingly or under compulsion, for God loves a cheerful giver. Each one must do as he has already decided. And the Corinthians have already decided to give. So he's saying that is what you must do. But it's a year down the road here. And they're not quite sure they really want to follow through on this gift. I mean, it's been a year. Think about it for yourself. Happens to me all the time. I get these wonderful ideas and desires to go do something really good for somebody. Then I get distracted. Then time goes along. A day, week, month, year down the road. You know, that was a nice desire, but oh well, life just moves on. And that's what's happened to the Corinthians here. And Paul is saying, now get this, you need to authenticate your Christianity by following through on that desire that you felt, committed yourself to a year ago. And not, he's saying here, not grudgingly, not out of coercion, to follow through freely. And again, I don't think he's talking about the amount of the gift, because back in chapter 6, he commented about himself that he's financially poor. And yet Paul was probably the freest of givers of all the examples that we have in the New Testament, amongst the New Testament authors, except for Jesus himself, our ultimate paradigm. So it can't be about amount, because the freest of givers was poor. So what is it? It's about the heart. It's about the motive, as he is explaining here. So each one must do as he has purposed in his heart. For God loves a cheerful giver. The word is hilarious. Laughing all the way through the writing of your check, or, you know. And remember, the context here is, it's about giving to people who are in need. For the Corinthians, it was the Judeans. For us, it can be the Zambians. For us, it can be the people in India. For us, it can be the people right here amongst us, right even within our own families, our wives, our children, our friends in our neighborhoods, people who are in need, to hilariously give out of a heart that's free to give. Because that heart is emulating the very heart of God, where grace is giving freely. In verses 8 through 14, for even if I boast, chapter 10. Let's stick with chapter 9, Earl, here. Okay. Verse 8, chapter 9. And God is able to make all grace abound to you, so that always having all sufficiency in everything, you may have an abundance for every good deed. God ultimately is the one who makes us sufficient, who gives us the desire and the willpower to choose to do what's good, and he does that through his grace. As God graciously, freely gives us his grace, that in turn allows us to graciously, freely give to others, Paul is saying here. Verse 9, as it is written, he scattered abroad, he gave to the poor, his righteousness endures forever. Now you might think that Paul is talking about God here. That's what I thought when I first read this. But you read where this comes from, Psalm 112. And the psalmist is talking about the kind of person that Paul is encouraging the Corinthians to be. Someone whom the psalmist calls fears the Lord. Someone whom the psalmist calls delights in the commandments of God. In other words, someone of a changed heart who fundamentally wants to be obedient to God. Paul is saying this is the kind of person that a person who has a changed heart is like. He scatters abroad. The reference is to giving. He takes what he has and he just scatters it all over the place. Money all over the world, all over the community, all over the church. Just his resources are scattered far and wide, is what the psalmist is talking about here. And he gave to the poor, and his unrighteousness endures forever, because his life is emulating God's, and therefore his own standing before God as a justified person by his faith will endure forever. So Paul's drawing on Psalm 117 again to encourage the Corinthians. This is what I want you to be like. Now he who supplies seed to the sower and bread for food will supply and multiply your seed for sowing and increase the harvest of your righteousness. You will be enriched in everything for all liberality, which through us is producing thanksgiving to God. But I admit, Paul says, that the ultimate supply of what you need to be free in your heart to give comes from God. He supplies you with that seed to sow. He supplies you with that motive, so that you be enriched in everything, verse 11, for all liberality. It's an interesting word here. The word can mean single-minded resolve. That you'll be enriched, you'll become wealthy, not necessarily financially, but you're wealthy in your freedom, your desire, and your choices to give, because you have this single-minded resolve and commitment to do what's right, that in and of itself comes from the grace of God. That in turn, at the end of verse 11, is producing thanksgiving to God. Here's the fruit of the righteousness that Paul is talking about. Multiply the seed for sowing, back in verse 10, and increase the harvest of your righteousness. The harvest of giving, the effect of giving, is thanksgiving on the part of those to whom you have given. And that is an important part of the process. Paul's already mentioned this in this letter. Notice how he goes on in verses 12 through 15 or 14. For the ministry of this service, he's talking about the Corinthians giving to the Judeans, is not only fully supplying the needs of the saints, it's not only allowing them to survive physically because they're starving to death and your gift is going to help them buy food so they can live, but also, notice, but is also overflowing through many thanksgivings to God. And that's really important to Paul. That the effect of this giving, in turn, sort of come back towards God. Verse 13, because of the proof given by this ministry, I think he's talking about the proving out of your faith, the ratifying of your faith, the authenticating of your Christianity, is what's happening as you follow through on this desire to give. You're showing that grace is at work in you and in your heart. Because the proof given by this ministry, this service to them, they will glorify God for your obedience to your confession and the gospel of Christ, and for the liberality, there's that word, that single-minded resolve, of your contribution to them and to all, or your participation in their needs and to all, I think referring to the Macedonians. You're participating with them in giving. while they also, by prayer on your behalf, yearn for you because of the surpassing grace of God in you. So you see, the cycle gets completed, the circle here. God in His grace gives freely. And His grace is giving freely. It is given freely that we in turn, of the Corinthians here, might also give freely so that the Judeans will respond to that gift with thanksgiving to God and then pray for the Corinthians, yearning for them as brothers and sisters that I think that they also endure and persevere in their faith. So it all comes back to God. Oh, go figure. But that's the important process that Paul is describing for us here. And I love this phrase at the end of verse 14. When I'll come back. How about verse 15? We'll just drop back. Thanks be to God for His indescribable gift. Notice what he has said at the end of verse 14. Because of the surpassing grace of God in you, thanks be to God for His indescribable gift. Here's Paul thanking. That's the point. He's thanking God for the grace that is in the Corinthians that's going to lead them to give. But notice what he calls it surpassing, or we could say extraordinary. That the Judean Christians will recognize the extraordinary grace in the Corinthian Christians. Now, why would he say it that way? You know why? Because it is an absolute miracle that any one of us ever cares one whit about another human being. That is extraordinary. Sure, people do it. We call it philanthropy. But they may not, but probably even in a world where there was no mercy from God, no changed hearts, people would still give. But it'd be out of pure, unadulterated selfishness. Only Christians, peoples whose hearts have been changed, can freely give joyously, hilariously, because they're responding themselves to the very grace of God that has been given freely to them. And Paul is saying that is extraordinary grace that I recognize in you and that the Corinthians will recognize in you. I'll tell you, when the elders said to me, we'd like to give you a 3-month sabbatical, I said, oh my goodness, what a gift. And I recognize in them extraordinary grace. And I thank God for them. When someone listens to your problems, prays for you, says, how are you? And they mean it. And they give you that little gift of love. I'm with you. I want to help you. Can I provide you with a meal? May I pray for you? What they're demonstrating is extraordinary grace. And I want to encourage you, get down on your knees and thank God for His indescribable gift of our Messiah, who was poor, who was rich and became poor, that you and I, who are poor, might become rich, and for the continued work of grace right here in people's hearts who are freely giving of themselves to others. How indescribable, extraordinary, something that we will marvel at for all of eternity. Grace is given freely, and it is giving freely. Let's have communion.